You're listening to Rendezvous with the Writer with Bobby Jean and Jim Bell, only on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to Rendezvous with the Writer, where readers and writers meet.
And story is everything.
We're your hosts tonight, Jim and Bobby Bell.
And we're delighted that you're joining us again tonight, whether you're with us live or you're listening or watching the podcast shortly after tonight or down the road. We're just delighted that you're here with us. That was our opening music, a gift from the Hot Texas Swing Band, and that was Hot Texas, Alex Dorman and the Hot Texas Swing Band. And Jim, we have a special guest
We have a special guest tonight.
Yes, we
Paris
do.
Paris Afton Bonds.
Welcome, Paris. You have to use your imagination. If you're watching, Paris is that circle right there.
Hola. Buenas noches.
Good evening. Good evening. So, Paris, are you dancing on sunshine right now?
Boy, it's hot sunshine. It was 109 degrees today.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, my goodness. Well, I know that we don't necessarily know where you're calling from. Obviously, someplace hot.
Yeah.
Well, we're delighted to have you with us. We are going to be talking with Paris about this really, really wonderful book called Answering the Call. I'm trying to get it in the camera there. And Jim has a little intro, Paris. I think he's going to, go ahead and read Paris's intro?
Let's do that. Paris Afton Bonds is the mother of five sons and the author of nearly 50 published novels. She is co-founder and first vice president of Romance Writers of America, as well as co-founder of Southwest Writers Workshop. Now, ABC's Nightline declared her one of the three best-selling authors of romantic fiction. A New York Times bestseller, Paris has been featured in major newspapers and magazines, as well as published in more than a dozen languages. Now, the Paris Award was established in her name by the Southwest Writers Workshop to honor a published writer who has given outstandingly of time and talent to other writers. Those who have received the Paris Award include Tony Hillerman and Norman Zollinger. Now, tonight we're chatting with Paris about her latest book, again, Answering the Call. Please welcome Paris. Good to have you here.
Oh, gracias. Thank you. I am thrilled to be here, truly.
So, Paris, we were just talking about all of your working, you know, with the Romance Writers Association of America and so forth. And so we all know and love you as a romance writer. And when you were with us on the writer's block a few times, we were always reading the latest Paris Afton Bonds romance, Answering the Call. Is this also a romance in the traditional romance sort of template?
Yeah, you would call it a romantic thriller. Yeah.
A romantic thriller. That's it.
See, Paris, we have to have some definitions here. We kind of went back and forth. You know, what is a romance novel? You know, and we understand there's rules.
Yeah.
What are the rules?
Yeah. What are some of the elements, without spoiler alerts, because it is a thriller? But what are some of the elements that go into the writing of a romance novel?
If it's purely romance, I will quote what Janet Daly said. And she said, either the heroine is thinking about the hero, or she is talking to him, or she is, what was the third one? But it's always about what is going on between the two. Mm-hmm. So that is pure romance, but you know, you have all spectrums of the romance. I do historical romances. Every novel has romance in it.
Yes.
That's true. Now, Bobby says something about romance novels have a happy ending. Is that a requirement?
You know, I think, and I'd like just to reword that, we all want to believe that there can be a happy ending, but really, Bobby and Jim, it means that there is a happy resolution to this particular situation addressed in the novel.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yes, there's at the end of the book, the reader is sighs a sigh of relief, like, okay, they got it together for now.
Yes, a story is about danger, how someone deals with danger. So you're building up all this tension, and at the end, you want to have the climax. No pun there. Yeah. And then there's that sharp drop off of the tension and relief, and the reader feels good when it's done, you know, plotted correctly.
Yeah. And the reader wants more.
Yes.
Is that one of the rules?
Yeah. Yeah. Because we really are engaged with the characters, and we may close the book, but we may keep thinking about them, or we may hope to hear that there's a sequel, or there's another in a series, you know, coming where we may revisit them again somewhere down the road in their lives, right?
That's correct. And because it's 109 degrees here, I'm thinking about having a sequel set in Scotland so I can go there.
Well, you know, it was always fun to catch up with you on the writer's block. And some of the things that we always like to talk about, we're going to get into the book specifically in a few more moments, but you are the mother of 5 sons. Where did you find, and you've been writing, you know, your whole lifetime, it would seem. How did you find time to raise 5 boys and write the amount of books that you've written?
You might add that I'm clinically crazy. my kids would say that. You know, it's true. I was even nursing, holding the baby in one arm and typing one hand. And I say typing. This was back before we had, you know, the internet, the computers. But right. I had an article published in Writer's Digest called Moment by Moment. And it's, you don't wait for a large span of time to write, because you're not going to find it. You do it moment by moment. You take sitting in the principal's office waiting to talk to the principal about one of my children, on the football bench, the cold bench maybe when they're working out, in the doctor's office. You just make time.
Mm-hmm. And were you always writing one magazine article or book, or you know, at a time, or did you have multiple projects that you were working on at the same time?
I really try to keep just one project, although I remember one year I did contract out to produce within 1 year 5 novels, and I cried a lot that year. Yes.
Oh, my goodness.
You know, first, any of your sons, are they writers at all, or are they all in different other professions?
They're all in different professions. One of them, Jason, who is, I'm so proud of him, he just got promoted to assistant fire chief, but and I won't say where, but he writes quite well. Yes.
Okay.
But the others, and you know what? Of course, they don't even read my books. They don't want to know what Mama's thinking.
You have to have seen a lot of changes in publishing over the years.
Oh, my gosh, yes. Starting with even writing, you know, we would write on typewriter paper with onion skin and carbon paper. And that was one change, just moving on to computers. But also with the ebook, with the digital book, huge, huge changes. And in some ways, it's wonderful because so many wonderful writers, talented writers, would get overlooked just by when there was just the major publishing houses. And now that's open where we can find all these wonderful writers that we can read and get involved with. But then that means also everyone can write a book, and there's just a billion books out there, and it's hard for writers starting out to get noticed now.
Mm-hmm. To get found. Yes.
Yeah.
You know, Paris, when did you actually start writing? When did your career start? You know, high school, college, when you were a little girl?
Well, I wrote my first story when I was either 5 or 6. My mother saved it, and it was called Black Girls Ride Again. My husband was with PepsiCo International when we moved to Mexico. So I thought, well, why not? I had some time extra there. Why not write? And I wrote about a dozen articles and short stories. The first one was sold to Modern Secretary magazine. And I went and interviewed the secretary at the American Embassy there and got patted down by the good-looking Marine on guard.
And you were hooked.
I was hooked from then on. So I sold about probably a dozen. And then we moved back to the States. And I thought, you know what? No one will know if I try to write a book and I fail. Only the postman, because you send everything out by way of the mail then. And I thought, go ahead and try it. And so I wrote the book. 6 months had gone by and I'd really forgotten about it. And I did what they advise. You go ahead and start another book. And I was really wrapping up the second book, which, as it turns out, got published first. But I got this call while I was ironing, and I'll never forget, Bobby and Jim, it was Valentine's Day.
Okay.
And I was ironing my husband's good shirt, and I picked up the phone and I answered, and I thought it was like publishing house, you know, where they're trying to sell you books, and I almost hung up on them. And then when they told me they wanted to buy my book, I started crying and doing the happy dance. And then I cried some more when I realized my husband's shirt was on fire.
I thought so. I thought you were going to tell us that.
Yep. It really happened.
That's funny. So it's interesting that you were in Mexico and that your husband worked for PepsiCo, because this book that we're talking about, I'm going to hold it up to the camera again, answering the call. Our main character, Lauren, and we're going to have you talk a little bit about her decision, but she, earlier in her career, she works for PepsiCo, I believe, and
yes, she does.
She makes a decision to go where? To Mexico.
To Mexico. I was wondering where were we going with this one? She makes the decision to go to Mexico. Maybe I want to put out a caveat that not everything that Lauren did in this book, I didn't do everything. That's what Paris did too.
Yeah. We should have a little quiz that we could put online. True or false, and then list things that Lauren, you know, that what Paris and Lauren, what things, you know, did they do this? Did they?
Oh, golly, please, no.
Well, you know, when you took the trip to Paris and you took the trip to Mexico by yourself, did you really have any fear at all? Or are you kind of like, hey, everything is cool and I'm going to have a great time?
That's a good question. As I mentioned, 50 years ago, a little over 50, we moved to Mexico the first time. So I had a sort of a working knowledge of Spanish. This is the most important part. At my age, I was 77 when I did this. I thought, what do I have to lose? You know, there's just a few years ahead. You know, even if I end up a bag lady, that's another adventure. So I sold everything, and I was a little bit concerned, you know, about how I'd make it all work. Once I got there, it was a whole lot more difficult than I anticipated.
Yeah, okay.
And Lauren kind of discovers that too. We are going to take a very brief spot here to let our readers and our audience know where they can find Answering the Call and all of the books from our guests on Rendezvous with a Writer. And when we come back, Paris is going to read a short section from Answering the Call. And then we are going to talk about Lauren and David and Renita and all kinds of characters. So stay tuned. Don't go away. We'll be right back.
Story is everything. Find a great one on Out West Shop's bookshop. Go to outwestshop.com, find books and CDs on the menu, choose Shop Out West on bookshop.org. Browse through featured authors on Rendezvous with a Writer. Explore curated book lists and our featured picks. Add in note cards, calendars, and jigsaw puzzles. One-stop shopping for great gifts. Use the search box to find thousands more titles. Make the switch. Your purchase supports us as independent booksellers. That's our story.
Welcome back. Welcome back to Rendezvous with a Writer. Our special guest tonight, Paris Afton Bonds. Answering the Call is the book, right?
Answering the Call is the book. Paris, do you have a short section you're ready to read and you want to set it up for us?
I do have a short section, and it starts right at the beginning. I would like to say again, just to remind the listeners, I did not do everything Lauren did in this book. But I will say, I experienced a lot of the feelings Lauren did. So here we're starting out with the feelings that generate this final decision to take the plunge and answer the call to adventure. And let's see here. There has to be an easier way. The words slipped unbidden and aloud over Lauren Hilliard's lips. Each morning as she showered, or sometimes earlier when Gropin shut off the alarm, the phrase audaciously intruded. Still, its daily surfacing never failed to take her by surprise. Naturally, her mind would be fixated on that day's demands. They centered around a monotonous routine, dominated by her older daughter's psychotherapist practice, which Lauren managed. Wake, go to work, return home, go to bed and read a while, go to sleep, or not, it was more often the case these days. Occasionally, lunch or an outing with friends or family interrupted that regimen. For how long now had these words gone on? There has to be an easier way, leaking in and out of her consciousness first thing in the morning, 2 or 3 years. Something within her insisted there had to be more meaning to life. She was aware that life was continuing around her, yet participate though she did, she in no way felt part of life. She was not clinically depressed, as her daughter Renita might label it, just apathetic. She tried meetups, book clubs, Spanish classes, hiking expeditions, choral groups, and more. Nevertheless, she invariably felt as if she did not belong anywhere anymore. For over a year, she had volunteered a couple of evenings or weekends at Houston's MD Anderson Cancer Center. In observing the magnitude of suffering and only occasional relief or remission for the patients, rather than feel fortunate for her circumstances, she felt burdened by guilt. Guilt because she had so much, yet felt so alone, so bereft. This, despite her good health at nearly 70, her family and friends, and her relatively stable financial security. Stepping from the shower, she toweled off, swiftly dressed in appropriate muted colors with low heels, and for a more subdued appearance, clipped up her dark, shoulder-length bobbed hair, shot full with gray. Lastly, she lightly swiped on the requisite makeup for the working woman of a certain age, mascara, a deft brushing of rouge, and a smudge of pale matte lipstick. Nothing vivid to attract awareness to her frame, no longer sleek, nor to the faint wrinkles amassing around her eyes, the marionette lines recently evidencing at both sides of her mouth, and the faltering flesh at her once firm jawline. A furtive glance in the mirror confirmed her dismal reality. She was gradually fading from view. That's it.
That's such a powerful opening. Yeah. And I know it engaged me immediately, and partly, Paris, because I am of that age of Lauren or close to. And as I read that, I almost felt a heat through my cheeks, because I was recognizing that in many ways that's me. And that's probably a lot of us at this age. And I would think men too, when you read those words, or as you listen, is there just some things there that
a couple of times I thought, you know, I'm really starting to feel old. If Warren doesn't quit talking about being old.
Oh, man.
But I think that's one of the, actually one of the really terrific engagements of this book and this story, is that we do have two major characters that are older. And for the reader, we can really relate. And I don't think you have to be necessarily of this age to relate, but I think if you are, you will feel this is a book for you. This is about people that are in your family, around the people that you might work with or volunteer with. This is our part of life. This is where we are in life, right?
This is
our phase of life. And
but we got two themes here. One, we got a lady that's obviously we have a lady that's aging, and that's in itself, just aging. But it's also, she's running out of time. There's got to be more things to do in life, and she's not getting them done. But she's not, to me, she's not sure exactly what she wants to do or how to do it, but she got to do something.
Yeah. Right. She is. And that's right. You get pushed to the edge. She's floundering, and then finally something happens that pushes her to the edge to answer the call to adventure. And I really, that is the theme of the book, that we're never too old to answer the call to adventure, to have a grand experience.
Mm-hmm. And there's some other things that she's experiencing that are things that I think sometimes I lay awake myself wondering, am I starting to lose my memory? Did I get that email out? I said I was going to get out. You know, you use a term lovingly gaslighted. Her older daughter is beginning to say some things to her that she's like, that doesn't sound like, no, I think I did that. But it's, Lauren is beginning to question also, is there Alzheimer's in my future? Is there some form of dementia? And she gets, you also, as the author, you talk about Velcro. She gets tight, like Velcro is kind of pulling her. And I go, that's a perfect way to describe that.
She just had it quite often. You know? I feel like I need to go pull that off, you know?
Yeah, get that Velcro off. But, I mean, I felt it just when tension gets so high that my shoulders feel like they're pulling back by Velcro. But as far as the worrying about, and we all do, and I feel like I've lost probably good 20-25% of my vocabulary from youth. I mean, that happens. But both a good friend of mine for 50 years has Alzheimer's, and then also my sister-in-law just passed with Alzheimer's. Mm-hmm. So it was in the back of my mind that this could be, and I made it in the book where I can't remember now whether it's her father or her mother that had Alzheimer's.
I think it's the mom.
She does have this worry, and it's what finally generates her to take this leap without looking.
Yeah. But what's so interesting is she takes that leap, and some of these things that you describe for Lauren in the beginning pages, even when she's in even more kind of dangerous thriller, we'll say, you know, thriller situations, she no longer has that question. When she wakes in the morning, she is no longer asking that question that she was asking every morning. And there's tension. As a reader, there are what's going to happen? You know, we're tense. But she, and she recognizes the danger, but she doesn't, it doesn't impact her the same way when she describes sort of physically how some of this was impacting her before she made the move. So why does she go, why Mexico? Why doesn't she go, you know, to Bali or Scotland or, you know, why does she go to Mexico?
Well, for one, she backpacked through Spain the year after she graduated from high school. Yes, so she had a working knowledge of Spanish. And then also, Mexico was really inexpensive, a good place, and many expats would tell you that, to live, you know, in a much better situations than you do here often. And then lastly, I lost my point there of why she decided, oh, she loves, it's exotic. Mexico is exotic. You know, it's something different. Just like David, whom she meets.
Oh, be still my heart. Yes, David.
Yes.
Well, she's a pretty resourceful character. You know, she encounters a bunch of terrifying, you know, incidents and things, and she, it appears to me, she handles them quite well. And,
if you want to create tension, you need to put the main character under a lot of pressure. And so now that she's moved to Mexico and I've put her under this pressure, it's only then that we don't have time to think, even here but in our own lives, we don't have time to think when we're under pressure. It shows the kind of person we are because we have to react without thinking. Mm-hmm. So that's what I wanted to do, to show what her essence was, despite her fears.
Mm-hmm. Her daughter, Renita, that she's been working in her medical office for 20 some years. Mm-hmm. You know, I would hope that if one of my parents had said, that's it, we're going to Mexico, I would have said, go for it. And now we have a place to go vacation, you know. But that is not her daughter's response, is it?
No, her daughter first, you know, she's losing a valued employee there for 22 years who made a lot of sacrifice and didn't get paid, you know, the scale that should have been paid, but was always reliable and responsible. And it's hard to get someone, you know, to be these days to be reliable and responsible. She's losing that. But then Renita, the daughter, has a lot of, the psychotherapist, has a lot of built up anger. And she has her own issues that are slowly coming to the forefront.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes.
I don't want to divulge.
No, I know. I know we don't. But she is not happy that mom has taken two suitcases and packed them and got out of town. She's where a lot of the tension in the storyline come from, because
she meets some interesting characters. Okay. Tell us about this David Escobar.
Yeah, just give us a little.
Wow. Well, I want to talk from a writer's point of view.
Yes.
Because, and it's sort of deviating from your question, but I'll come back from it. They say when you're writing about a character, you should know everything. You should know what kind of ice cream he prefers, what time he wakes up, what he reads, you know, on and on. And for me, it's like visiting on a vacation, visiting a seaside town, and you meet the people and you get to know them a little bit on the first draft. The next year and next summer, you go around and you know more about them and you become friends. By the third draft, you're the best of friends and you know everything about them. So to me, a plot is what reveals the character. And little by little, I'm developing that character that the plot will expose. And as far as David now, back to David. he's exotic. He's both, he's as home in a tux as he is in street grunge clothing. He hangs out with the president of Mexico and also with the underbelly of Mexico. He is resourceful. He's also compassionate. He has a son that you can see he's devoted to. So that's mainly our David. He was he was, as a young guy, what was he, 16 or 17? I'm trying to remember now. On the border in the burial and ferrying migrants, and he got caught and put in jail for 18 months. So he knows how to navigate around both the underbelly and the upper world.
He's a good guy and a bad guy and really hot, right?
Yeah, really hot. And he's all of us. I mean, we all have our foibles and our follies. I certainly have my follies, my man.
Yeah. Well, you know, I kept thinking too as I was reading, I don't often think this way, but like, okay, who would portray David on the screen? Do you have him?
Yes. You
and
know,
Laura,
one of my readers sent me a photo and I said, bingo, that's him. She said, if there's ever a movie made, you've got to use him. And his name is Jeffrey Dean Morgan. Jeffrey Dean Morgan, if you're listening, please call.
I'm going to be looking you up when we get off the air. Do you have an idea for Lauren?
Someone suggested Meryl Streep and a couple of other suggestions, but I really don't. Yeah. Do you have a suggestion, Bobby or Jim? Do y'all have a suggestion?
I hadn't thought about it.
I kept thinking different people. You know, she is such an interesting character. She really is. And I think one of the things I like about both Lauren and David is that, and I think you just described how it happens, the plot does begin to reveal them. And David, for sure, when we first meet him, we think of him a certain kind of way. It's not a stereotype. It's not a cardboard character at all. But we kind of go like, okay, I've seen that character in, you know, this situation drama. I've seen.
Yeah, watch out.
Yeah. Don't be in a dark alley with him. Don't trust him, you know. But as we move along, these characters become people, and they have, you know, good days and bad days, and he kind of likes to really protect his heart, doesn't he?
Oh, absolutely. He gave his heart to his wife, and before Lauren there, and because of him, she was exposed to danger and was murdered. So he's very careful about giving his heart away. He didn't want anyone else exposed to danger.
And I think that's one of the things that keeps the reader reading and keeps us really engaged, is because we get more and more involved. In fact, talk to us about, she's so fun, Andy Lyons. She's so important to the story, and what a kick. Tell us about where did she just announce herself to you, or how did
that's a good question. Where'd she come from?
Where did she come from?
Yeah.
You know, Bobby, you said it correctly. She just showed up. I did work for one of my sons. He's a doctor of chiropractic, so I worked for his office for 20-something years. And different people would come through, and I really, really loved working with the patients. And so she's a conglomeration, but she showed up, and I thought I was just going to use her for one scene just to get some certain things accomplished in that scene to move it forward. And she kept showing up. And I really could not identify with her, because she was from a younger generation. She had tats, piercings all over, purple hair spiked, you name it. And I had to get her out of the picture, but she insisted and she stayed. And I came to love her. And so you think she should be in the next sequel, huh?
Oh, I think there's a whole series with her.
Yeah,
and
she's
you know,
a hoot.
She's really important to the story. Now, when you, in the section you read aloud, you describe how Lauren gets dressed and, you know, how she what she wears, office appropriate. Andy's in the same office, and you just shared with us a little bit about Andy, which is just a total reversal. I did wonder what was it about Andy that Renita decided, you know, I need to have her on my staff, because she seems just so, you know, she seems so out there.
Actually, Renita did not want her, but Lauren, I felt sorry for her because, as it turns out, Andy came from a home that did not work out well, and she was floundering on her own and just 18 years old. And Lauren took pity on her and fought for her to stay on.
Right, right. And actually, I could imagine that Andy was mostly, I think, handling the patients as they came in. She was kind of the front
desk, yeah.
Right? And I would imagine that a lot of patients, that they would feel almost, she would put them at ease a little bit, because she's just so, you know, she's just out there, you know.
She's not judgmental. That's one thing I liked about Andy. And she has no fear of anything. Bring it on.
So
the young patients who came in for, you know, for psychotherapy there, as well as the older ones, they were entertained.
Yeah, they were. I know you have some questions that you just need to get in and jump right in here. Uh-oh. Jim.
We'll just, you know,
Jim.
Andy's a nice person. Let's talk about this really super bad guy. Hunchback, macho, nacho.
You do want to bring him up. Okay.
We call him a sicario, like a hitman or a assassin.
Yeah, a hitman. And he is, in writing, I don't know if you've heard of this book. It's The Hero's Journey. I'm sorry, The Writer's Journey. You need, he's the guardian at the gate, really. Because the real hitman is the man he's employed by. But I just had to have him show up to keep putting larger and larger obstacles in the way of David and Lauren.
Yeah. And along with him come some of these other, not themes exactly, but there are some things, you know, what we were talking about.
We get into
the thriller elements.
Yeah, we get into those nasty things like organ harvesting. Taking over.
Gangs, yeah.
And just even when Bribery. I was down there, it was so, and I'm not taking a platform here, but it was sad to see the trek of people escaping execution and torture and all the horrific things that are going on in other countries, and trekking through Mexico, and you drive along the highway where you're in your nice car, air conditioning, and they're walking thousands of miles. So it did. I needed to put that in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. You did you know, When this book, the characters announced themselves to you and you started to tell their story, did you already kind of know a lot of how it was going to go down, or did you just kind of start writing in it and they revealed the story to you?
I knew virtually nothing. In fact, I really wasn't planning on writing the story. I had moved to Mexico. I wanted to, you know, lay out on the surf and enjoy it and not work at all. But just the incidences that I was experiencing generated the story, but I did not know what was going to happen next. And in most of my stories, I really don't have a tight plot, but I know that I have the major, the protagonist, the antagonist, their goals, whether they're mutually exclusive or not. And then I know the most important part of the book is the climax. So I have those three things in mind. And when I moved there and I saw that aqueduct, I thought, that's got to be at the climax.
Right. And they do, you do take us through some really lovely, I knew you had to be doing some research while you were there. We go to a vineyard, I think. They have a lovely, and
I
some
went
other
there.
Places. So those scenes, we know that we are seeing through the author's eyes and memory what you experienced when you, like, especially
Absolutely.
That aqueduct. Yeah.
I searched far and many, many times at that aqueduct to to find a tree that would suit my needs. That's all I'm going to say.
Yeah. Yeah. And you found one.
Yes, I did. I've got a photo of it.
Yeah. So you didn't write it into the story. There is really one there. Yeah.
Yes.
Yes. Do you have a favorite place that you like to write?
Can you specify more? You mean like in my office?
Yes. Or, well, I know you were sharing when you were raising the boys, you were kind of writing wherever. Yeah. But I didn't know if you have that happy place that you go in and there's your comfortable chair and there's your, there's your margarita and you put a little music on and maybe you have a light or maybe you're just writing by the light of the laptop or, do you have a favorite place that really feeds your muse?
No, I don't have. I like the word you used, happy place. No, it's a place of struggle. Some days I just dread going in there, but I know that, whether I've contracted on a book or not, I know that it's something you do and it will get easier. It's getting past that first draft that is so difficult for me. So I write wherever. I mean, I've written in places you would not imagine still.
We're talking with Paris Afton Bonds, and of course, we're talking about the wonderful romance thriller Answering the Call. It encourages us all to answer the call that we are maybe hearing in our lives, and we have the mute button on. We're going to take a very short ad spot for our sponsor, Out West Shop, and we'll be talking more with Paris when we come back. Stay tuned.
Here at the Out West Shop, we're passionate about the American West, the truth and the myth. We're purveyors of fine Western goods. We scout for unique and distinctive apparel, accessories, home decor, and general merchandise that are a reflection of the Western lifestyle. We hunt for unique artisans and craftsmen who are inspired to create decorative art you can wear based on their own love for the story of the West. We round it up and bring it to you. Check out OutWestShop.com when you need anything Western.
Welcome back. Welcome back to Running with the Writer with Paris Afton Bonds, Answering the Call. Book with
Paula.
I get it. Just a little question for me, you've written, like you said, over 50 books. Just, is there an average time it takes to write a book for you?
About 6 to 9 months, usually. Okay. And I would tell you that it never gets easier. And if it is, I start to worry because you're being repetitive. You're not exploring and expanding. So it's never easier for me.
Okay. Now, a little question that we sometimes ask, and I know on the other show is asked all the time. Do you ever get writer's block?
Good question. No. To me, there's a million ideas in the library. What I get is just stuck in a scene or something, and it could take me an hour or two of walking around. It could take me a day, but usually within 2 or 3 days, I get past that. I call it stuck. It's not a writer's block. It's just what would work. What works best to make this scene move forward. There's a lot out there, but I just had to find the best way, the best idea.
When you're reworking a draft, you have your first draft done, and now you're going back through. Do you find as you're editing that you can get stuck again? Or is the getting stuck part mostly with the first draft?
Mostly with the first draft. I love the second, third, and fourth, and sometimes fifth draft. I love it. It's the polishing, the honing. It's the fun part.
Yeah. Is writing a villain character difficult, or is that really fun?
Surely you've thought about, if I could just choke that person. Surely you've thought that, the person who's cut you off in, on the highway. villains, if you're going to have a realistic villain, you're going to have to also portray what they do care about. You know, you want them to be 70% evil and 30% good. And I'm making up that percentage, but I think you understand.
Yeah. Yes. So I'm just looking at our clock. So Paris, what's coming up next? If you can share anything.
Well, I think we talked about it briefly. I'm already on the finishing up the first draft of the sequel to
All Right.
Call, and it's called So Done.
So done.
And that's what shows up. And you had mentioned, Bobby, that you had something that, and I loved it, that comes to you every morning.
Yes.
Do you mind sharing it?
No, I don't mind at all. When I first wake up, just like Lauren, I have a thought that just comes immediately, and it is this the day? And it's open-ended. And on a good day, it could be, is this the day of a new opportunity? Is this the day that a writer that we've been wanting to, you know, to get for the show actually is able to find an open spot? Is this the day? And it's a get up and go, you know, get up and go kind of thing. And then there are days when it's, is this the day that is my last meal, my last supper day?
Yeah. Know?
Is this the day that I have, you know, I'm going to see the doctor for a basic routine, you know, checkup and maybe
yeah,
something, you know, is this the day that I do work and we ride share and we share the car and my husband picks me up. And I always wonder, is this the day when I come out of work, he's not there? So, I think as we get older, and I think we don't talk about it, I think it's something, you know, we don't necessarily even share with a good girlfriend, excuse me, but I couldn't help, as I was reading Lauren's first sort of thoughts about the day, that, yeah, and I wonder if we don't all have something like that, that is that voice, you know, that talks to us.
Well, knowing that you're drawing out closer to the end of your life, and we all have such wonderful dreams of our youth, and sometimes we lose the thread to them, and what happened to them, and will I find it this day? Jim, mm-hmm. Do you have anything that you get up in the morning and think?
As we talked before, my thoughts are not near as philosophical. I get up thinking, I don't think I got enough sleep. Let's see. Am I going to make enough money?
And the other most important one, we do look at each other now and we make sure we know each other's names.
Like, who are you?
Who are you? Do I know you?
Well, you should know each other. I know you've been married a long time, and I think that's so admirable.
Yeah.
I have to write about aging people who are very happy in their marriage, so maybe I need to interview you two later.
So where can our readers and our listeners and all, where can they find you, Paris, and where can they get your books?
Well, my books are available everywhere. The books are sold both, you know, online and in bookstores. And I'll deliver a book if you'll order it. I'll come and deliver it just like DoorDash does. Okay?
Oh, yeah, yeah. We want that. Jim has a couple of quotes that we love to kind of begin to wrap up the show. Go ahead, Jim. You have a couple of quotes to share?
You and today, both the quotes are from the book. From... From a book, and about, you know, the one is from, first is from Lauren herself, who says, "For all the sad words of tongue and pen, the saddest are these, it might have been."
Yeah, those are actually from Laura. They're anonymous. I don't know who they're from, but she was remembering. Yeah,
what might have been.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it is. So I don't want to look back and think, did I miss that? What might have been if I didn't take this opportunity?
That's why we have to answer the call.
Because interesting enough, one of her friends, he's actually a whittler, and she's talking to him before she heads on south into Mexico, and he has a quote for her, and he's really quoting Henry Ford, the car guy. "If you always do what you're always done, You will always get what you've always got.
Yes.
Answer the call for adventure. Oh, Paris, this has really been great fun. We so appreciate you being with us tonight.
I had a great time.
Yes, thank you. And next week, we're just going to wrap real fast. Next week, we are joined by Kathleen Morris. I've already started to read Gold Digger, the legendary Nellie Cashman. This is a really wonderful, another really great book. We want to thank all of you that have come along to participate in Rendezvous with a Writer with us. And Jim, do you have a closing thought for next till next week?
Well, remember, it's always a great day out west.
See you next week. Keep reading.
Adios. Adios. Bye-bye.
You're listening to Rendezvous with the Writer with Bobby Jean and Jim Bell, only on LA Talk Radio.